talk about attachment, we're not just talking about dependency upon others because we need them to do something for us. I'm excited to share this new episode with you. It's all about newborn babies, but not about parenting newborn babies. It's about the newborn baby in you. It's about the experience that you had or didn't have and how to strengthen and nurture your capacity to engage relationships with those you love most. This episode is generously sponsored by Allie and Alex Grange in memory of Shira Shangla Basak-Bryan, who loved being a mother and had a passion for Judaism and psychology, Nehem Neshama, Heaven Aliyah. Also by the Granges in honor of their new daughter, Emuna Gabriella, with thanks and gratitude to Hashem. Relationships are too important and too challenging to take for granted. Welcome to The Attached Life, where we explore the magic and the madness of our most meaningful relationships. We're starting in the beginning of how we become the people that we are, how human beings develop, and how each of us has ended up with our particularities, our habits, our strengths, our weaknesses, our tendencies, and in particular, how we show up in relationships. So what is that beginning? The truth is we can't start in the beginning because we have no idea what the beginning is. The beginning is ultimately a mystery. Is the beginning in the womb? Is the beginning conception? Is the beginning previous generations? Is the beginning something non-physical? Is the beginning something in the mind of the Creator, being part of the infinite? There's a reason the Torah starts with a bays, the second letter of the alphabet, not with an aleph, because beginnings are always inescapably, perpetually, chronically mysterious. We can't ever actually access the true beginning. So we're going to start with the beginning as we know it, with coming into this world as an independent entity, as an independent person, as a newborn baby, separating from the mother and now existing in this world as a person unto itself. There's some amazing research done in the late 70s that showed how early that newborn baby begins to attune and attach and form relationship and engage with those around it. The research showed that after 42 minutes being in this world, just 42 minutes, babies already began starting to try to mimic the facial expressions of the caregiver, the facial expressions of the adult next to that child after 42 minutes in this world. So if the caregiver, if the adult opens their mouth, the baby will try to open his or her mouth, stick out his or her tongue. Whatever it is that the caregiver is doing, the baby is going to try and mimic that. Of course, in the beginning, it's going to be very weak, very minimal, but progressively more and more. Attachment starts right at the beginning because we're wired for attachment. Attachment's a word we're going to use a lot. So much of what we're going to talk about is rooted in what's called attachment theory. So let me just say a word about what this means. Attachment theory really wanted to be called love theory. John Bowlby had said that he wanted the person who had initiated, began attachment theory, along with a whole host of other researchers and psychologists and theorists as well, he wanted to call it love theory. The only reason he didn't was because he felt he'd be laughed out of the scientific world, out of the psychological world at the time if he had called it that. He couldn't call it relationship theory either because that was still not scientific enough. And so he came up with the word attachment. But really what we're talking about is the desire. When we talk about attachment, we're talking about the desire to connect, the desire to live in relationship, the desire to experience love, to experience connection to another person, to live life in a way that is a shared experience, not an isolated experience. When we talk about these kinds of connections, though, when we talk about attachment, we're not just talking about dependency upon others because we need them to do something for us. It's a mistake to think that this newborn baby is mimicking the facial expressions of the adult next to it just because it needs the adult to feed it or to give it safety or to give it clothing or to change its diaper or to give it food. That's a mistake because in addition to all those things, which of course the baby needs those things, but it's not just those things. What attachment theory found is that even if a child has all those things provided, the child will very possibly show up as if it doesn't have those things provided. It's a group of children studies that were done in what's called failure to thrive, young children who looked malnourished even though they were being fed ample food and given all the things they need. But they weren't given emotional connection. They didn't experience relationship. They didn't experience love. They didn't experience all the extra adoring that parents will often naturally be able to provide to their children. And when that wasn't provided, all the other practical utilitarian services and goods of food and clothing and warmth, that wasn't enough, because that's not the only thing that we need as humans. What we really need as humans is connection in addition to all those other things. There was a study done by a researcher named Harry Harlow, who took a bunch of young monkey children and put them in a room. This later became questioned by ethical standards of research, but the outcome of this research is really pretty profound. He set up two, so to speak, surrogate mothers in this room. One of them, neither of them were real monkeys. One of them was a food-providing, so to speak, monkey, but it was a wire. It was a wire figure, just cold wire, but it gave food. And on the other side of the room, there was a mother figure set up that didn't provide any food to the monkeys, but was very warm and cuddly, cozy kind of feel. And they watched these monkeys over time, which of the two mother figures these monkeys would go to. And after some time spending time in this environment, they then introduced into the environment a startling sensation or stimuli, something that would, so to speak, frighten the young monkeys. And they were curious which of the mother figures would the monkeys, in a flash, when they only had a split-second instinctive reaction without thinking, which of the mother figures would these monkeys go to? And what they found is that every one of the monkeys went to the more loving, warm, cozy mother figure in that moment of need, even though that mother figure had never given them any food. Because the bond that's formed, that attachment that's formed, is built more off of the emotional connection, more off of the warmth, more off of the loving feeling and experience than the practical need to be fed. So as a newborn baby, this is already happening. The reason the baby is mimicking the parent after 42 minutes is not just because they need food, but it's because they're actually already wired to want connection. And everything that's happening at this stage, at this early stage, this newborn baby literally just coming into the world, this is the groundwork. This is the foundation for everything that's going to happen later. There's a concept in Torah that whenever we want to understand a word in the Torah or a concept in Torah, we have to go back to the first place that it's found. We have to go back to its original use, its original appearance. And if we can understand it there in that original appearance, in the original use, we can then understand all the further instantiations of it, how it shows up in all further uses. Because the original experience of something is the seed level. It's where the foundation is established, and then everything else subsequently follows from that. So if we don't understand the human being, we go back to that basic original foundation layer. That's the newborn baby. It's happening. The attachment development and the human being becoming who they are is happening at that earliest stage. For a lot of people, I would imagine, this might seem like a difficult concept or a bizarre concept to really believe. It might sound a little bit out there, a little bit foreign. But I want to try and explain it in a way that I think will really establish a very important foundation that we're going to be utilizing throughout all these episodes of Understanding Human Development. We typically think of ourselves as human beings through the lens of our conscious awareness, our thinking brain. And of course, this part of us, this thinking brain, is a very important aspect of who we are. It's an essential aspect, and there's so much. We'll get to that as we go on. It goes without saying, it's an incredibly powerful aspect of the human being. In some ways, it's the crowning feature of a human being. But that conscious awareness, that thinking self, where we're aware of what we're thinking, where we can think about thinking, where we can consciously experience things, that is only one layer of the brain. The brain is, of course, incredibly complex and beyond anyone's comprehension, but certainly mine. But I'm going to give you a basic structure of what neuroscience has taught us. The brain in this scheme, in this basic scheme, is made up of three layers. There is the back of the brain, all the way in the back, which is what they call the reptilian brain. This is almost, so to speak, like the basement, the foundation of the brain. And the reptilian brain is connected to our bodily functions, our bodily sensations, to our physical body. When we experience instinctive responses, we experience adrenaline rushes, we experience the fight-flight response or the freeze response when our body functions in the way it does, that is connected in many, many ways to the back of the brain, the reptilian brain. Above that, in kind of the middle of the brain, almost if you think about it as if like the first floor of the house, we have what's called the limbic system. And the limbic system is where we have the emotional brain. This is where we have feelings and emotions when a person feels sad or happy, excited, scared, lonely, passionate, etc. That's in the middle of the brain. That's the limbic system. On top of that, almost as if the second floor of the house, in the front of the brain, is where we have the frontal cortex, the neocortex. And all of that is where we have our rational thinking, our logic, our consciousness, the ability to think about things, etc. And that's the front of the brain. Now, what's really important to understand is that actually, in our experiences, we often don't realize this, but the back of the brain, the body level of the brain, the reptilian brain, the animal brain, is actually what experiences and reacts to stimuli around us first. It has the quickest perception of everything that's happening around us. After that part of our brain perceives what's happening without us even consciously realizing that we're perceiving it. So we perceive it on that level of the brain, and our body responds before anything else. After that, the limbic system comes into play and we have feelings, and after that, we have conscious thinking. And it happens in that order. Just as a side point, I think it's fascinating to think about the idea that when we wear tefillin shel rosh, the tefillin that we put on our head, so we have the bias, the house that goes on the top in the front of the brain, specifically in the top frontal section of our head, just above our forehead, which is really where the neocortex is. It's where the thinking brain is. And that makes sense because inside this little box, we have words. We have words from the Torah. That's where our thinking comes in. And then we have the straps connected to it that loop around, kind of cross over the limbic system to almost as if encompass it, to surround it and include the limbic system, the feelings, and come back together in the back of the brain in a knot, specifically in the knot, right where the reptilian brain is located, right in the back towards the bottom. And that's where we have the knot. Because a knot is not so much a thinking brain, it's an inherent connection. It's attachment that there's a bond, it's bound together, it's knotted together, it's tied together. It's beyond thinking, it's beyond the partios, it's beyond the words of the Torah. It's that which is deeply, deeply ingrained and inherently implanted into that deeper, deeper layer in the foundation. That's the basement, that's the foundation, that's the initial attachment, which is not in the form of words, but it's in the form of a knot. Two people tied together, the person tied together in the case of tefillin with Hashem, with God. And in the context we're talking about now in this newborn baby with its caretakers, it's that ability to have attachment that is formed on that base foundational level. So coming back to this notion that the baby, as a newborn baby, does not even have the frontal cortex of the brain developed yet. That doesn't happen until way later. The limbic system is not really developed yet either. These things aren't online yet. What's there in the very, very beginning is that foundation level, the basement level, the reptilian brain, the sensory motor experience of the world, which we'll get to that in a moment, but the physical interaction with things around us. So as a newborn baby, we're not experiencing consciousness. We're not aware of what we're experiencing, but we are experiencing it. And so the mapping of the nervous system is already happening. It's all happening right there. And it's laying the groundwork. It's building the foundation, the map that everything else will be built upon. So when the newborn baby experiences someone else, a different person who has a regulated nervous system, who appears in a calm place, the newborn baby is now able to access in its body an experience of calm. When the newborn baby experiences distress from someone else, when someone else shows up with distress, the newborn baby now experiences that distress in its core level nervous system. That's all happening right from the beginning. It's pretty incredible. From that perspective, I think it actually flips around a lot of what we think about. Just, I can speak for myself personally. So I have a 4-month-old baby, which actually makes doing this episode and thinking about this very meaningful because I'm experiencing this in a very hands-on way. So I was thinking about this. If I was on the phone, let's say, and I was in an argument with someone in my life and it was getting heated, I was in a conversation that was very conflictual, very tense, I would most likely try very hard to avoid having that conversation in front of my children, my 10-year-old, let's say, or 8-year-old. Things happen, but I would really be conscious and intentional in trying to avoid that happening. But I don't think I would think twice before having that conversation while holding my 4-month-old. I would be able to hold my baby and have that conversation, and I don't think I would even consider that as anything wrong. And in thinking about this concept that we're talking about right now and that I'm trying to put out there for you, I realize that that's largely backwards. I mean, of course, I don't think I should have the conversation in front of my 8-year-old or 10-year-old either. But if I'm holding my baby, whose nervous system is being mapped out right now on its foundation level, and I'm physically holding him, or he's in the room and he can hear the tone of my voice, and I'm now in a state of activation of fight, and I have the stress going on in my body, the baby's nervous system is now picking up on that, and that's happening now for the baby. So it's a very different way of relating and thinking about what's going on. So what determines how the attachment at this level of things is developed? What's happening for the child, for this newborn baby, in the attachment development in this earliest stage? So there's different developmental theories that are out there. Two of the very well-known developmental theories are from someone named Erickson and Piaget. Those are two of the more well-known. The idea of developmental theory is that at different stages of life, we go through different developmental stages. We go through having different aspects of human development take place at different points in time. So according to Erickson, the very, very first developmental phase, which is the newborn baby, is the phase of trust versus mistrust. So the newborn baby without consciousness, without awareness, without thinking about it, but in their body, on that reptilian level of the brain, they are experiencing the world through the lens of, can I trust or do I not trust? Are the people around me trustworthy or not trustworthy? Is this world that I just entered into a place that is trustworthy or not trustworthy? And their system is being mapped around that question. What makes them believe that this world is trustworthy or not? On a very basic level, it's whether their cries are heard, whether they're tended to and cared for when they express need. And it's not just, are they taken care of in that just practical way that their diaper is changed, but it's also the tone of voice that they're spoken to while their diaper is being changed. Are they disgusting? Are they being disliked but taken care of? Or are they welcomed, embraced into the rhythm of existence around them? Are they wanted? Does the newborn child, the newborn baby, experience the world as wanting them to enter into its existence? If so, the child now experiences a sense of trust of the world. The world that I just entered welcomed me into its experience. But if not, then the child develops a sense of mistrust. And here's something that's really interesting and I think very powerful. The research shows that children who had inconsistent, untrustworthy attachments early on, they don't seek less attachment later. They actually just seek untrustworthy attachment figures later. So they will get into relationships later in life with people who are not trustworthy, which speaks to this concept that we're developing of how inherently ingrained our need for relationship and attachment is. So it's not a matter of do we need it, will we look for it? We need it and we will look for it. The question is how. So if we experience trustworthy attachment, good enough attachment, then we will seek trustworthy people to be in relationships with later because that's what we know, that's how we know to attach. But if we experience untrustworthy people, we're going to look for relationships later with people who match that because that's what our foundation level knows as this is how you have attachment, this is how you have relationships. That's Erikson's model. Piaget's model is different, but I think it actually really kind of creates an overlay in a very nice way. Piaget says that what's going on at this earliest stage is what's called the sensory motor stage, where it's the experience of the world, not with anything conceptual or anything symbolic, but only in the physical contact with things, with objects around. But the core developmental progress that's made is what's called the concept of object permanence. So the baby experiences the touch of the mother or the father, or the touch of an object. Initially, when that parent, that person, that object is removed, and the baby no longer sees that person or feels that person or hears that person. So initially for the baby, that person is now completely gone. They don't exist. There's no sense of existence for that person's there. What develops in this initial stage is the idea of object permanence, is that when that person or object now reappears, the baby begins over time, over the continual experience of appearance and disappearance, essentially the game of peekaboo. It's no coincidence that people do that with babies so naturally because that's actually what's happening for the child. What they begin to develop is the ability to know and to trust, which is where I think this fits back into Erikson's idea. They begin to develop the ability to trust that even when this thing is gone, it's actually still in existence and it will return. And the ability to experience something as leaving and coming back is so important for the child's development because if the child only experiences, let's say the child was given 100% of the time perfect, unflinching, unwavering connection that the parent decided to wear a baby carrier, let's say, for the first 6 months and never let the baby off of their body. So the baby would never experience any distance, any sense of separation. What would happen is that the baby would actually not be able to develop trust because the baby in that foundation level of the map, as we're talking about, would never, the map would never be able to integrate and to have mapped onto the nervous system the possibility of misattunement and then attunement again, of being able to experience separation and then togetherness again. And that's an essential part of our development in life. We need to be able to experience that something goes wrong, something distressing happens, and then we can come back into regulation. We can go into distress and then back to regulation. We can experience separation and then come back to togetherness. We can have that the object is no longer here, but then it comes back, that sense of object permanence. It doesn't disappear. It's not completely going MIA. It's not leaving my life. It's not leaving existence. There's just separation. The ability to have that experience is so essential for everything we're going to experience later in our lives. So part of the experience for the child is actually not to be cared for in that overly enmeshed, overbearing kind of a way, which the attachment is there 100% of the time, but it's to be able to experience attachment in a way that creates trust, that creates that object permanence. In therapy with adults, the therapy that I do, I actually bring up newborn babies quite a lot. Because there's another aspect of a newborn baby that I want to bring us into at the tail end of this, which is that so many people, for a variety of reasons, which we'll get to in later installments, experience their sense of self and their sense of value and worth in a very, let's call it utilitarian kind of a way, meaning to say that in as much as I am able to provide utility, in as much as I'm able to do something for the world, I'm able to produce something, I'm able to accomplish something, in as much as I have certain talents and qualities and productivity, I have value, I have worth, I'm wanted. That concept, that notion of our conditional worth, our utilitarian worth, our worth in as much as our productivity is a very important concept for human, for healthy human development, because we do need to be productive and we do need to have that sense of motivation and the importance of those things. But if that's all that a person has, if that's the entirety of a person's sense of self-worth, it's very, very fragile. It's a precarious way of living, because the moment that I mess up on something, I don't have worth until I fix it right away, which again is an important concept. These things are very subtle, but we need to have some sense of basic goodness, basic worth unconditionally, a basic sense of I have value in this world, I'm wanted in this world just for being me. Because having that sense of inherent value, that I'm willed into existence, I would argue the value comes from I'm willed into existence by God, and that inherently gives me value. Because if a perfect being who has all the value wills me into being, then I have value right there, and that's enough. If I have that in the background, in the foundation, then I can venture out to take risks. I can mess up. I can succeed. I can do things out of a place of intentionality and not a compulsive need to be productive at every moment. I can live a much more wholesome and healthy life. This is a concept we'll talk about in a number of different contexts. But the reason that I bring up newborn babies in this context is because I think that almost anyone, when they come into contact with a newborn baby, experiences the intuitive, natural, automatic sense that this baby is human life, and that in this human life there is value and there is worth and there's something precious. And you might say, well, yeah, but that's just because the baby will be able to become something that will be someone who's able to be productive and accomplish and contribute to the world. But I don't think that's why we experience it. I think that that's more of a frontal cortex rationalization of the automatic experience of just sensing a sense of worth. And most people are able to access that. Even the people that I've worked with and that I've spoken to who have a very extreme version of human worth existing only in as much as there's productivity, when we do this exercise of imagining yourself, or if you have a child, or if you have a niece or nephew, or anyone in your life, especially if they're close to you, that you got to meet as when they were born, as a newborn baby at a very young age, when you experience that child right in front of you, even if you're not a baby person, still, when you come into contact with that baby, there is a mysterious, very clear sense of value and sacredness to this human life inherently, just as it is. There is a poem that I like that speaks to this concept. There's a collection of poems called Memo to Self by someone named Ruth Lewis, although I believe that that was a pen name. She has a poem called FFB. For anyone who doesn't know, that phrase refers to from birth, religious from birth, which is in contrast to someone who became religious later in life, as we oftentimes refer to as a Baal Tshuva, someone who came to religion later in life. But FFB, the concept of being from birth. So she writes, what an expression, FFB, from birth. I see an obstetrician holding up a newborn baby, a girl weighing 7 pounds, 3 ounces, wearing a long black dress to her ankles, black shawl, white apron, carrying a tiny sitter under one arm, already swaying piously over her tehillim. Alternatively, it's a boy, comes the cry of joy, 9 pounds, 2 ounces, a stooped figure, with a long white beard, long black coat and hat, a cane, spectacles perched on the tip of his tiny baby nose, chuckling over his Gemara. She goes on, the poem continues, but what I like about this poem is the kind of parody of this concept of from birth, because as a newborn baby, of course, none of that is present. There is simply human life, simply existence. And there is a sense, a wondrous sense of value. And we can all return to that level. And so what we're trying to do here, if there's any value that comes to this from a perspective of parenting or taking care of a newborn, I'm, of course, very happy for that to happen. But that's not the primary goal. The primary goal here is for us as adults trying to build and nurture our capacity for attachment. The more that we as a baby got all that stuff that we needed, and it's never perfect. And like I said before, it's actually better that it's not perfect. The more that we got what we needed, the more capacity we have for attachment. Because the more trust we have, the more object permanence we have, the more of a regulated nervous system we have, the more of that healthy foundation, basement layer, reptilian brain that we have that allows us to be in deep, meaningful, intimate, vulnerable connections with other people. And in any ways that was undernourished or didn't get what it needed is going to lead later in life to potentially to the different habits or challenges we have that hurt us in our relationships or in our ability, our capacity to connect. But one of the most amazing, truly incredible discoveries that took place not very long ago in world history is the idea of neuroplasticity. And what neuroplasticity says is that the brain, as much as there is this foundation layer that was established in us a long time ago, and some of these things can be deeply, deeply rooted and deeply ingrained, but the brain is plastic. The brain can change. And so one of the ways that we can change the brain is by having new experiences. New experiences will change some of that brain map, especially when we have those experiences in a way that's intentional to develop the underdeveloped muscles or to reroute the mapping that took place. One of the other things that's an amazing discovery is that we don't have to even have those experiences in actual life, because some of those experiences we can't have. We can't re-experience birth in actuality. We can't re-experience our first moments in this world in actuality. But what they found is that fantasy or imagination in the mind actually comes shockingly close to having a real experience. So we can create the changes in the brain by imagining having a new experience or a different experience. So there's a concept from a school of therapy called somatic experiencing of what's called a corrective experience. I'm sure it exists in other schools of thought as well. So many of these things overlap in different forms of therapy. I'm familiar with it from somatic experiencing and Peter Levine. The idea of a corrective experience is almost like a vitamin. If you have a deficiency of something in your nutrients in your system, you can take a vitamin to supplement whatever deficiencies you have. So if we have attachment muscle deficiencies, if we have certain undernourished attachment nutrients in our system, we can use this corrective experience vitamin to try and build that capacity back and to try and nurture and strengthen any of those wounds and strengthen those muscles. So I'm going to guide you through this, and I invite you to check this out. You might think that you can't even access what your reptilian brain, your basement layer experienced at this level because it's so unconscious, it's so deep below. It's not something we can know through conscious memory. But you'd be surprised, sometimes you actually can access some intuitive knowledge of what that may have been like for you. So before we do the corrective experience, I'll invite you to explore the following exercise. If you can take a moment in a quiet space, and notice your surroundings, and notice your body, and just try to slow down Try and pay attention to whatever comes up naturally, spontaneously, without thinking, without trying, without effort. To any of the following prompts, notice what you feel in your body on a sensation level, not even emotionally, just physically, as if you were talking to a medical doctor. What are the sensations in your body? Are they pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral? So when you think of being born, when you think of coming into this world, just intuitively, what do you notice? When you think of a delivery room that you can try and imagine or picture being born in, what do you notice? What images come to mind? What thoughts pop up spontaneously? What sensations do you notice physically? When you think of your first moments interacting with a caregiver, with a parent, if you imagine that, what do you notice again? If you explore any of these prompts or anything else similar, you might access a window into what some of that experience may have been like for you. Because that intuitive body response or the intuitive thoughts that don't come from effort but come naturally, that's coming from the unconscious. That's coming from that deeper layer beneath our consciousness. So I want to take you now into a corrective experience. So again, if you can find a place, find a time, find a moment, you can pause this and then come back to it at any point, where you can find some quiet and you can rest and slow down, noticing your breath, noticing the surface you're sitting on. Notice how your hands are resting, allowing your eyes to gently close. And when you're ready, you can imagine coming into this world. Try to imagine the most idealistic version of how you would want to experience that. And because this is taking place in fantasy, in imagination, the sky is the limit. Anything is possible. Imagine a perfectly smooth delivery. No complications, no pain for anyone. Maybe there is music playing. You can set the volume just right to how you'd like it. You can choose the song to exactly what you wish it could be. You can imagine that the lights are on a dimmer, so you can set the lights to exactly the setting that feels perfect for you. And imagine who's around you, who's there to greet you when you enter this world. And again, it doesn't have to be realistic. It could be the people that would have made sense back then. It could be otherwise. It could be imaginary figures. It could be people in your life now. It could be people from back then. Who would have been there to celebrate your coming into this world? And imagine that everyone around you has everything that they need for them to be in their best self, in their fullest, most regulated self, so that they're not being hindered or burdened by anything. They can just be there fully for you, with their bodies being so regulated, with all the warmth that you need. Who's the first person to hold you? What are the first words that you hear say to you? Imagine the eyes that you would want to see looking down upon you, gazing at you? The first finger is to stroke your tiny little cheek. And allow your mind to conjure up anything else that could have been there to leave you feeling celebrated, wanted, that your existence is welcomed into the rhythm of existence, that the world around you and the people around you are trustworthy, are there for you. And notice what all of this is like physically in your body as you experience it. Notice the sensations, trying to locate the pleasant sensations of what this is like, and to allow that to be mapped into your system. And take your time to experience this fully, as much as you can, as much as you'd like. Feel free to pause this so you can allow yourself the time, all the time that you might like, to experience this. Whenever you're ready, you can slowly and gently open your eyes and notice what's around you, orienting back to the present, becoming aware of any sounds, sights, touch around you. And that concludes our exploring of this first stage of human development. I hope you enjoyed it, and I look forward to continuing next time into the next phase, the next stage of how we develop as human beings in this journey of experiencing attachment in this world and developing our unique ways, our unique capacity for engaging relationships with other people.